At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Why do people with normal cholesterol levels get heart attacks? Heart surgeon Dr. Philip Ovadia believes it's because of poor metabolic health, not cholesterol. After performing over 3,000 heart surgeries, Dr. Ovadia decided to work on prevention and not just treatment. In his book, Stay Off My Operating Table, Dr. Ovadia shows you his 7 principles of metabolic health and how to use them to reduce your risk of heart disease. Get your free audiobook version of Stay Off My Operating Table at ifixhearts.com/Zuby. That's ifixhearts.com/Zuby to get your free audiobook. Go check it out.
I am the man, sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the gram, stunt me, you're destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam, put some respect on my name. Sick like Obain, click and I bang, y'all gon' remember the name. Y'all gon' remember the name.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. On today's episode, we have got on a brilliant guest. We have chatted many times on the social medias, but this is our first time having a conversation face-to-face. We'll surely have one later down the line in person. She is a board-certified plastic surgeon and also the host of the Netflix show Skin Decision. And this is, of course, Dr. Sheila Nazarian. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. It's such a pleasure to be here. I've been so looking forward to this chat.
Fantastic. So Sheila, I've done a very brief intro there, but for those who are not familiar with who you are, tell them a little bit about yourself.
Well, like all of us, I feel like we're all very multifaceted human beings. Yes, I'm a plastic surgeon. I'm a mom of 3, a 15-year-old, 14-year-old, and an 11-year-old. I'm married to a brain and spine surgeon. I'm actually first-generation Iranian Jew. We escaped to this lovely country that we both enjoy. I've just recently, within the last few years, become a big activist as well. Just seeing my kids being a couple years away from college and saying, oh my God, I have to speak up, or I'm sending them off into war with nothing to defend themselves. So it's just, I love doing all of the things in business. I love the activism. I love familyhood and motherhood. I love fashion, just all the things.
Amazing. There's so much that we can get into here, but I know you have a really interesting and unique backstory. So let's start there. Tell me about your childhood.
Yeah, sure. So I was born in 1979, the year of the Iranian Revolution. My mom actually flew to New York so that I would be a U.S. citizen. So she was like 9 months pregnant. I think she had me at like 10 months pregnant, probably not the best. But once I was born, we went back to Iran. The revolution was in full swing. Lots of anti-Semitism, lots of racism against Jews, but they wouldn't let us leave. So we were kind of stuck there. Then the Iran-Iraq war started. There was bombs flying everywhere. I remember sirens would go off in the middle of the night. We'd run to the windows and my parents would be like, look at the fireworks. And so that was happening. A bomb landed a couple blocks away from our house. We were seeing what the treatment of women was becoming. And my parents just had 2 daughters. And my dad was the chief medical officer for the Shah's Heart Hospital. He's a pathologist. And one of his lab techs, he had saved his eyesight. My dad had diagnosed a parasite in his eye and saved his eyesight. And so he came to my dad. He was part of the besieged, the Revolutionary Guard. He said, listen, you saved my eyes. I'm going to save your life. You're on the list. You need to get out of Iran like now. And so my dad left my mom, my sister, and I's passport with the government, said he was going on a medical conference. So he flew out to Vienna, stayed with one of the professors he had met at one of these medical conferences, and just every day worked on sort of helping us get visas so that we could get, you know, eventually out to meet him as well. My mom, my sister, and I, one day we went to the bazaar like any other day, and we got in the back of this car. We were kind of curled in the fetal position around each other with strangers that we didn't know. They put burlap sacks on top of us and corn. And that's how we got, kind of got close to the Pakistani border. And I remember there was something sticking up from the bottom of the car and it was digging into my ribs. And I told my mom, like, you know, I was really uncomfortable. She's like, shh, just have to stay quiet for a while. Just take it. So we got to the border. We went to this hole in the ground, which they called a bathroom. And that's where my mom told me we were going to America. And I just remember saying, I'm going to meet Michael Jackson, because that's what America meant to me. We had all these like bootleg Thriller videos. And I remember like being in our living room at home in Iran, and I would try to learn the dance. And so that's what America was to me. I was super excited. And, you know, then we spent one night in the desert on our way to Pakistan. And then the second night, that we were almost across the border guard saw our pickup truck, and we were just sitting in the back on top of our luggage with other people that were getting smuggled out as well. They turned on the car lights because they had been seen, because they started shooting at us. And then we went over a ravine, like two wheels were on one side of the ravine, two wheels were on the other side. And the border police was like, that's too risky. And they didn't follow us. So that's how we made it into Pakistan. We had to stay in Pakistan for 3 months waiting for our visas to come through. And eventually we reunited with my dad in Vienna. And I remember being at the train station, not recognizing my father, because I, you know, I was 6 and a half, 7 years old, and I hadn't seen him for months. And when he had shaved his beard, so I didn't recognize him at all. And he started speaking, and I was like, oh, that's my dad. And so we stayed in Vienna for about a month and eventually made it over to the States.
Amazing. So what year did you arrive in the USA?
1985.
Okay. And what were your first impressions?
You know, it was tough. So I came in, I didn't speak any English. I was such a nerd. I was in ESL. It was tough. I got teased a lot. But I learned English rather quickly and, you know, didn't necessarily have the best clothes. And I was super skinny. Like, I remember when we were studying anorexia, everybody was like, oh, like Sheila. I was like, I'm not, I swear. but I was just one of those like really thin, like fragile looking kids growing up. But I was smart. I had total imposter syndrome. I didn't think I was smart. Every accolade I would get, or if I got accepted into a special program, I'd be like, they're going to figure me out. I'm not, I don't belong here. They're going to figure it out. But my mom was kind of always my rock. And she always told me, you're beautiful, you're smart, you're special, even though I wasn't receiving any of that messaging at school. So that's one of the things I always try to remember with my own kids, is you are their rock. You know, you are their unconditional love. They high school is so much, I feel like, harder even now with cancel culture, and like, you can't say this, or you have to tiptoe around everything. And so I just try to remember every time I get angry or impatient or anything like that, that I have to be what my mom was to me, because she really helped shape like the person that I am now. Unfortunately, you know, she passed away when I was 16 from breast cancer. And that was, you know, something I kind of, we didn't have therapy. I feel like therapy was like very taboo back then. I probably should have gone to therapy. But what I did is I just started working harder and making sure my dad was okay, my sister was okay, and just throwing myself into my schoolwork and trying to kind of not think about it. And I remember not even crying for like 6 months after it had happened. And, you know, as you know, like big life events, you know, when I got married or I had my first child, and just not having my mom there was very difficult. But before she passed away, she told me, she said, I gave you roots and the wings to fly. So, you know, she really gave me those roots, which I'm so grateful for. And she always said, you know, you can accomplish anything, you can do anything. And again, just the power a parent has to affect someone's self-worth and self-image is amazing.
Yeah, it's the most important job in the world. And I know that people say that, but I don't think people fully understand or think about just how important it is, because it doesn't just affect your children. It affects everyone who ever in that child's life is going to interact with them, right? If you raise great children, then they go on in the world and they do all sorts of good and positive things and help other people. If you raise bad kids, then it's not just bad for them or even yourself or your family. It's you know, harmful for society.
Zuby, I want to hear about your childhood. What were your parents like?
Oh, my parents are amazing. My parents are amazing. I talk to them several times a week. They've been married for almost 50 years. So my dad is a physician. He's a medical doctor in the UK. Of course, a lot of people know I grew up in Saudi Arabia. So I lived there for 20 years, and my parents used to work over there. Both my parents are originally from Nigeria. I'm one of five. I've got nine nieces and nephews. I'm the only child that does not yet have children. So, yeah,
no pressure.
Actually, there is no pressure because I'm the youngest. So, you know, the first four are out the way. So I kind of get left alone. Yeah. And no, my parents are incredible. Anytime anyone I often get asked in interviews, you know, who are my role models or who are the people I look up to or, you know, grew looking up to. And I always say number one, you know, my mom and my dad. So they did an amazing job and they continue to do an amazing job. My dad is, well, I was going to say my dad's very much like me. It's more like I'm very much like my dad in a lot of ways. If you imagine a 40-year older and wiser version of me.
How could anyone be wiser than Zuby?
give me another 40 years. And yeah, he's got like encyclopedic knowledge on religion and history and biology and the human body and medicine. And yeah, he's a very, very, very sharp guy. But yeah, God bless my parents. They're wonderful. And it sounds like you had wonderful parents as well.
Thank God.
Yeah. So tell me more about the story from then on. So you went to university in the US. Let's continue with the story.
I actually went to Columbia University. Early decision, applied to one place. And back then, Persian girls didn't leave the parents' house unless you were getting married. And if you did, it meant you're a whore, basically. So, my dad always said, you know, go to the best school you can get into. And I totally remember I was like, Dad, I got accepted to Columbia. And he goes, Khoboro, which means, okay, go. So I went to Columbia. I think that's when I really like came out of my shell and like felt pretty and like all those good things for the first time, which was actually awesome. I always tell my kids, stay nerdy for as long as possible and you'll be fine. So I went there and then I went to Albert Einstein College of Medicine in the Bronx and that's a Yeshiva University school. And then I got accepted into a plastic surgery program at University of Southern California. And then in between my general surgery training and plastic surgery training, I went to the Marshall School of Business as well and had three children during residency, which was insane and not easy at all because it was like pure exhaustion. Everything's a blur from that time for those 8 years. And then I just came out and started my own practice. Very early on, knew how to be successful. I knew how to market. I knew how to read a balance sheet. I knew how to communicate in a way that was really effective and informative. And so I just started making a bunch of videos because I knew people didn't want to read anymore. I was like, people don't want to read. I'm going to make a bunch of videos. So I think I was one of the first plastic surgeons on YouTube. And as you know, Google owns YouTube. And so my SEO and all of that search engine stuff, just I was on the first page of Google within 2 years if you search Beverly Hills plastic surgeon. And just to give you an idea, there's 31 plastic surgeons just in my building. So that was quite an accomplishment. I call it the car lot of plastic surgeons. I just started doing pretty well and it became almost like a video resume. I was getting tons of press, tons of media opportunities. I always knew I wanted my own show. I was a dancer. I did theater. I love being in front of a camera. And I love impacting the masses. I feel like doing surgery one at a time is amazing, but if you can impact the masses, that's really gratifying and fulfilling to me. So eventually we got, you know, the Netflix show after a few tries and it did really well. We got nominated for an Emmy, which was crazy. it was COVID, so I did the whole Emmy thing from my kitchen table. I didn't really get the red carpet experience, unfortunately, but it was still really cool. I just feel like every year is just so different from the year before. And it's all about just being flexible and creative and being diversified in your businesses so that, you know, if one thing happens, you can kind of sweep in with the other ones and just keep on swimming.
Amazing. Man, there's so many directions that we can go here. But what is it that made you want to study plastic surgery and become a plastic surgeon of all the different options that you had?
When I was little, I was very like crafty. Like I would always do like stupid stuff, like build a suitcase out of duct tape or something random. My mom would always say, which means the expert in useless things. But I really think all of that stuff really just prepared me for becoming like the plastic surgeon I am today. Did wood shop. I was the only girl. I think it was the fourth grade and I wanted to drop out because I felt super awkward, but I kept going. I loved like the almost obsessive compulsive blueprint making, like your arrows have to be a certain way. The number two has to be written a certain way. And I just love that precision. And then building it was so much fun. So I said, okay, maybe I want to be an architect or an orthopedic surgeon. I kind of knocked out architecture because I actually wanted to build it. I just didn't want to design it. And then so I started shadowing an orthopedic surgeon for 7 months. Wasn't that creative. It was very cookie cutter, like literally. And so I was kind of disappointed. And then one of my friends was like, well, why don't you look into plastic surgery? So I started shadowing a plastic surgeon who eventually became one of my mentors. And it was the perfect fit. And I will say this, if I didn't get accepted into plastic surgery, I would have gone into like the business of medicine or something else. Because the only thing in medicine I wanted to do was that.
I hear that. And you said that you, when you started your practice, you had all of these various skills from business to communication, all that. Are those things that, where did that come from? Are those things that you think you sort of naturally had a proclivity for, or are those specific things you learned in business school or from your family experiences? Where did that come from?
Well, I mean, I think being a dancer and like being comfortable on stage and perform, you know, being performative, whether you're a comedian, a doctor, a teacher, that those are all performative, I think. Like when you walk into a room to pitch, you know, your music, you have to read the room. You have to say, how am I speaking to this person so that they, you know, react and kind of identify and connect with me. So I think that was very helpful. As far as the business stuff, so I actually wanted to be a religion major at Columbia. And I walked in the first day to class and the guy said, I don't give out A's. And I wanted to go to medical school. So I was like, okay, well, this isn't going to work out. So then I switched to philosophy. They didn't give out A's. And I was like, okay, what are all the jocks majoring in? They were all in economics. I'm like, okay, I can get an A in economics. So I made
I'm curious as to this, we don't give out A's. What's that about?
You know, I think they wanted to like, I don't know, weed people out or like see who was serious or I don't know what, but they were like, we don't give out A's.
Oh.
And I was like, okay, well, I need it. Mama needs A's to get into medical school.
I was going to say, if they don't give out A's, doesn't that just mean that a B is an A essentially?
Yeah, but not to medical school, right?
Yeah.
So I just started doing economics and I was actually super fascinated by it. I think it is like very similar to religion. I think it's very similar to like philosophy and sociology. It's kind of like, how do people think about what they're investing in or what they buy? Or, you know, just it was very interesting stuff. Like they were saying during a recession, lipstick sales go up, right? Because people don't have money to splurge on clothes or jewelry or certain things, but they want those little, you know, happy moments. So they buy a lot of lipstick. Right. So it was just like super interesting things like that. I was like, wow, that's fascinating. And so I just got really, you know, kind of like it was kind of like a nice little primer to it. And when I was in residency, business school, as you know, typically wants you to be out in the workforce for 3 to 5 years before they accept you. But I got in as a resident. I was the only resident they'd ever like taken. And I felt like that was really interesting because there was such a diverse mix of people in my classes. Like we had the chief medical officer of NASA, We had people, physicians that were running insurance companies. We had physicians that were running hospitals. We had private practice. We had I think it was just so cool because when there is diversity in the room, you get so many different viewpoints on one subject. And I thought that was really, really neat. We learned how to make a business plan. Every project that we did sort of resulted in your business plan, which I think was invaluable. And I didn't particularly like P&Ls and balance sheets. And I think that's what's missing a lot now from like, live your best life, like all these posts on Instagram, live your best life, like make it in your 20s. And I'm like, no, you have to suffer in your 20s. Like you have to take classes you might not actually enjoy so that you can be successful later on with the skill set that you've obtained. So I have to unfollow those things. They drive me nuts. But yeah, so, you know, taking some of those classes wasn't as much fun as I would like to have been having. But now running my own businesses, how could I communicate if I didn't know the verbiage of accounting and finance? How?
Yeah, I hear that. And when you started your practice, did you have a particular specialty? Was it a certain procedure that people were primarily coming to you for, or was it more general?
No, I mean, I always went into it with the reason why most people go into plastic surgery, Zuby, is because we don't want to do one thing. Like, I don't want to be a heart surgeon and stare at the heart all day. You know, I don't want to, I don't just want to do one thing. So plastic surgery is surgery on the entire body. So I really just enjoyed that mix of stuff so that I wouldn't get bored. I also had a ton of devices. The first 3 years, every dollar that I made went back into the practice, whether it was for advertising, device purchases, whatever, decorations, whatever it was back into the practice. And so I think that I was kind of like a good mix of surgical and non-surgical. And that was very attractive to people. I almost became like a one-stop shop. So they didn't have to go one place for their facial, another place for their laser hair removal, another place for their skin laser, another place for surgery. It was almost like, okay, we don't age in one dimension. If I'm doing your facelift, I'm also going to laser your skin so it matches how young your face looks. So I think that natural results, not looking like an alien, was my specialty. which, believe it or not, wasn't so popular maybe 10 years ago, but is kind of popular now. So I feel like people are like slowly coming into the aesthetic. And I also think it attracts the people that I want to be spending time with. So I always say what you put out there is what you attract. So I put out normal, intelligent, don't want to look like an alien. I show myself injecting my own face, but I don't look like an alien, hopefully. And so I attract super successful, well-adjusted people who aren't narcissistic and just, you know, have generally good health, but need help with this one little thing. Like working out's not going to lift your face up, you know, or your boobs or your butt. So it's just been really fun. I have the best patients. You know, we spend like 15 minutes on aesthetic talk and like 45 minutes on investments and tax planning. So it's a really fun, it's like social hour, really.
Yeah. What do you think are some of the misconceptions and myths and misunderstandings that people have when it comes to plastic surgery? Because, I mean, for me personally, it's quite a neutral term. I think we're all aware of the excesses of it and some of the stuff that is crazy, whether that's people looking like aliens or walking around with, you know, boobs the size of giant watermelons or doing crazy, you know, there are some real crazy and, you know, I would even say unethical stuff that does exist and that can be done with it. But then there's also stuff that's, you know, much more mild or minor or moderate, or, you know, of course you have people who even have injuries or, you know, burns, accidents, certain things that maybe they're even born with that they feel very self-conscious about, all those kind of things. And I think it's positive to help people, you know, regain their self-esteem and confidence and things like that with particular things and hangups that they have with their body. So what are your sort of general thoughts in that area? First of all, what do you think are some of the misconceptions?
Well, I think the misconceptions come from two things. A, before my show, kind of typically the shows that are about plastic surgery on TV are kind of making fun of the patients or kind of like more of a circus sideshow type of representation of what plastic surgery is. But our show was very like very ethical, I think, and beautiful, and really showed docu-style why these people are getting these things done. Like the first episode, one of the patients was shot by her husband 9 times and just wanted to get the scars removed, right? Yeah. Or acne scarring. Something as simple as that can really get in the way of someone's confidence. It's on your face. You know, you can't really cover it up. So it can, I look at plastic surgery, whether it's a craniofacial deformity that someone's born with, whether it's a burn, whether it's reconstruction after breast cancer, it's all about quality of life if you think about it. So let's say you have to have a mastectomy. You can live without a breast, but we pay for it to get reconstructed because it's a quality of life issue and it's a confidence issue. That's how it is. Whether I'm in the ER sewing up someone's forehead, doing hand surgery, like all of those things are really quality of life issues. And I look at them all the same way. And the other side of it is that you never, Zuby, notice good plastic surgery, right? So if you're walking down the street and somebody has fantastic plastic surgery, you can't tell. You're just like, wow, she looks good or he looks great. But you only notice the crazy. So it's like plastic surgery gets this bad rap with most representation on TV, and also the fact that you only notice the bad work or the unethical work or the crazy work. You don't notice the good stuff. So we're kind of that place where somebody might show up with big lips or massive breasts, but we're the ones they come to dissolve it. We're the ones they come to downsize. We're the ones that make them look normal again. Yeah. So that's our niche. That's our practice. But yeah, I mean, I think the myths are that it's narcissistic, that it always looks fake. Like I'm known as the small breast queen. Like that's my hashtag on Instagram. And people fly from all over the world just to get B-sized breast implants, you know, and not get pushed to D. Where a lot of people push, oh, you're going to think you went too small. Why is it's not even worth it if you go that size? No. You know, it's what matches that person's body and looks natural. So, yeah. So that's kind of, we're trying to make plastic surgery, give it a good name, do things ethically. Because you're right. I mean, ultimately it is the plastic surgeon who's the gatekeeper.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm curious. So when you say quality of life, that's a term that you've brought up a couple of times. Who determines that? Because it's something that, you know, there can be people out there who maybe are very narcissistic, you know, truly, or who have certain body dysmorphias, or who have certain hang-ups, or, you know, there are certainly people out there who don't, almost like they don't realize what they look like.
Does yeah, so ultimately, I mean, I hate to say it, but in my practice, I decide that. So okay. We have questionnaires for mental health in their intake forms. Is someone forcing you to do this? Did someone say something to you about this body part that you're inquiring about that's making you come in here? Is anyone forcing you to be here? Do you want this surgery? How long have you been thinking about this? Whether it's any aesthetic procedure, it could be Botox. Mm-hmm. Like I had a guy come in, he was a lawyer and he had these, you know, 11 lines between his eyebrows. And he's like, my wife sent me here. She says I look angry, but I am angry. And I'm like, I don't want this. Like, go. And it was a simple thing like Botox. And I said, go, you don't want this. You're not doing this for yourself. So you shouldn't get it done. It could be something as simple as that. I've also had people ask me to remove their navel. I've had people ask me to cut off their earlobes. So that's a hard no, both of those things. So ultimately, I'm the gatekeeper. So when I walk in the room, people think they're interviewing me. No, I'm interviewing you. Because I give all my patients my cell phone number too. And really, I'm like, is this somebody that I want this person to have my cell phone number?
Yeah. In terms of the wider profession, what do you think are, so of course, you have your own boundaries and personal moral compass and ethics that guide you. But clearly, there are some people doing some of these procedures who, you know, I can see by the results that they don't, right? There's people who will just take money and add whatever thing that the person thinks that they want. How do you think that minefield is best navigated, sort of as a, I guess, as an industry or as a society? Or I don't know exactly what the laws even are when it comes to this stuff. Like I've seen,
well, I mean, putting in massive, putting in massive breast implants is not against the law, right? But again, it's almost like, what are you putting out there and what kind of human are you attracting? And is it all about the money? And sometimes it is all about the money for people across all industries. For me, I always said, I want to sleep well at night. I'm not hungry. My kids are in good private schools. Like, we're, I have a house. Like, I'm good. I'm just going to ride this out very ethically and, you know, stay true to my core values and be a good role model for my kids and for my patients. But no, I mean, I think that there's that in every industry, right? Whether it's the music industry, lawyers, right? There's people that will do anything.
For sure there are. And I would say that, definitely. Every industry has its issues and its potential corruption and ethical problems. I would say that with something like plastic surgery, though, in particular, because you are altering people's bodies, right? You're cutting and stitching and adding and removing. And so, I don't know, say in the music industry, yeah, sure, there could be certain issues, but you're not cutting anyone up. You're not physically altering people in this way. I don't know if you're it's a little bit like, how would I put it? I think in different, every industry and every profession has its potential problems. I would say that for some, it's more severe than in others, right? If you get a bad plumber is less of a problem than a bad police officer, right? A bad pilot or a bad surgeon has the capacity to do way more damage than a bad math teacher.
I mean, it goes along with, you know, the privilege of being able to do this and knowing the trust that people put in you and, you know, being ethical when you have that much trust. I mean, look at politicians. We vote for them. We trust them. Do they always deliver on the responsibility that we've given them?
I worked that one out a while ago.
I know. No, but you know what I mean? Like that's you know, a lot of trust there too. So I think we have to represent. And the other hard part too, Zuby, with my profession is that a lot of people claim to be plastic surgeons, but they're not. So a lot, you know, these people are like, oh, plastic surgery death in Florida, like every other week, right? These people are not real plastic surgeons. They just say they are. And the press doesn't
define. What do you mean by that?
So they could be a OBGYN. They could be an there's eye doctors that are doing breast implants. There are dentists doing facelifts. It's not illegal. So every physician in the US, Subi, gets a physician and surgeon license. So if you're an internal medicine doctor, your little certificate says physician and surgeon. Okay. Why? Because if you're the internal medicine doctor on a farm with no other doctor within 200 miles, you're going to deliver a baby. You're going to stitch people up. You're going to remove cysts. You're going to do those things. Right. So in the US, there is this issue, for better or for worse. It's good in some situations, really bad in other situations, where once you graduate from medical school, you get a physician and surgeon license. So it's unethical to claim something you're not. And if you get sued defending that in court, it's going to be tough. But no, they do it and they do it all the time. And they call themselves cosmetic surgeons instead of like, let's say I'm a board certified cosmetic surgeon. That's not a real board certification.
That's so interesting. I didn't know that. I have learned something.
So a lot of times we get a bad rap and the press doesn't differentiate either. They're like plastic surgeon, like blah, blah, blah. And I'm like looking this person. I'm like, I don't know who this person is. Look them up. They're not. They were like, I don't know, an allergy doctor.
That's interesting. I didn't know that. I actually thought that the specialties were more differentiated in terms of the accreditation. I didn't know that you could be
boards and we pass our boards. Yeah. I mean, all the questions are very direct to what we're doing, but once you're out, there's so many people, you know, kind of, we call it, working out of their scope of practice.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
That's why it's so important to ask your doctor, what did you do your residency in? Because you can say, are you board certified? And they'll be like, yeah, I'm board certified. You didn't ask them what they were board certified in. Or wow. they can lie and say I'm board certified in the Board of Cosmetic Surgery, which is a fake board. Doesn't exist. No oversight. Wow. So, you know.
Are the terms
you train in?
Yeah. The term plastic surgery, what's the true and proper definition of that? And what's the differentiation between plastic surgery and cosmetic surgery?
Well, cosmetic surgery is a sub-branch, or we call it aesthetic surgery, is a sub-branch underneath plastic surgery. So when we become plastic surgeons, we have to train in hand surgery, microsurgery, meaning taking a muscle and moving it to reconstruct a breast, or motorcycle accidents, taking a muscle and covering the exposed knee bone or shin bone so that that leg survives. So microsurgery, burn surgery, and ICU that goes along with that is a lot of our training. And craniofacial. So when people are born with, you know, cleft lip and palate, shape, the regular shape of their skull that will impede how their brain grows. So all of those things are the base of our foundation. So when someone comes in for hand rejuvenation, I've seen all those tendons. I've put all those tendons back together. I've fixed those bones. So my understanding of what appears to be a simple procedure is going to be very different than someone who trained in eye surgery, right? Mm-hmm. So I always say our training is like a pyramid in plastic surgery. We learn so much, and then we specialize into one of these five things. Whereas the other people, their training is in something complete. It's like an upside down pyramid, right? Their training is in like eyes, but they're doing like boobs, or they're doing liposuction, or they're doing things. So we have a very broad training, and also plastic surgeons work with all the different specialties. So we have to speak the language of every specialty. So the orthopedic surgeons, when they put a bone together, we have to cover the bone so it doesn't get infected. When brain surgeons, you know, do a flap to expose the skull, if that flap dies, we have to bring in like a neck, something from the neck to cover that flap so the bone of the skull doesn't get infected. So we have to speak the language of every specialty, and we're available for every specialty to help. And I think people don't realize that. They just think like we're beauticians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I think the term plastic surgery, I think people's brains tend to jump to just sort of vanity treatments. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's where the brain tends to jump, even though it's not an accurate assessment of the whole field. And I'm sure there's plastic surgeries who don't even do any of that.
They kind don't. Of stuff, oh, there's right? many. Yeah. yeah. There's so many yeah. plastic surgeons who do no aesthetics at all.
Mm-hmm. How much has the industry changed since you've been in it? How has it changed over the years?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's swings. So, you know, surgical was like like big Pamela Anderson breasts and like, you know, that sort of thing was huge, and small butts. Now, then it went through a stage where everybody was doing minimally invasive and non-invasive, like fat reduction or lasers or injections. Now it's swinging back again towards surgery. People just want a one and done fix. I think with COVID, a lot of people were on Zoom, so neck surgeries literally skyrocketed. I've never done so many facelifts like ever. I was doing like two a week. It was crazy. And also people really, I think, were confronted with their mortality. And they were like, life is short. I'm going to do this stuff. I'm going to be happy, and I'm going to take care of myself. So the other thing that I noticed is people really wanted advice from experts. And I feel like influencers became a little less influential, especially when it came to skin and these procedures. Because again, through COVID, people were really looking to the experts. They didn't care like what Joe Schmo said. Now I think it's going back away from that. I saw Zuby's like left eye start to twitch. So I think that was helpful. You know, and honestly, like, I'm like you know, politically and in philosophy and stuff like that. And so I think a lot of my patients, and I was very loud about it too, which was crazy, because I thought literally I was going to lose all my patients, and the absolute opposite of that happened. So
okay, tell me more about that. I'm actually really curious, especially with you being in the belly of the beast in Los Angeles.
Yeah. So I was like, you know, when I first came out as like pro-Israel and I started speaking, I lost like 3,000 followers on Instagram within 30 minutes. Like I was like, wow. But I was just like, you know, I had heard this saying that up until the age of 40, you need an ego to sort of grow and like have drive and to succeed. And after the age of 40, it's about grounding yourself and letting all of that go and paying it forward and sort of giving back. And so I was like, okay, that's my Instagram. I grew it. and I'm going to lose it all, and but I'm going to be myself and it's going to be great. So I just kept going. And that was like a real big lesson to me, is like, you can't get canceled unless you submit to it, right? Yes. If you keep going, new opportunities open up. And I've gotten so many, like, I've gotten to meet so many cool people like you, and gotten so many interviews and speaking opportunities. And with my patients, I actually had one patient call and she's like, colonizer or like whatever. Oh, gosh. But the rest of them, I would walk in the room and they're like naked, because I, you know, doing a post-op check for like whatever I did to their body. And they're like hugging me, crying. And they're like, I loved you before. I'm obsessed with you now. And like, thank you for what you say. And thank you for being you. And so how sad is it, you know, that my parents left Iran to come to America to have free speech, to have all of this stuff. And now I'm a hero for speaking my mind. Like, mm-hmm. So sad.
Yeah. Does it sort of amaze you, especially as someone who came to the USA in the mid 80s, does the way that things have sort of shaped out over the past 30 to 40 years, is that, do you find it weird? Because I feel like we're going through this strange inversion, or this strange sort of topsy-turvy land where, you know, up is down and down is up and right is left and left is right. And it's like it's sort of come full circle in this strange way where even speaking sociopolitically, we've reached a funny stage where a lot of people who are quote unquote considered conservative are more liberal in many ways and do a better job of defending and conserving traditionally liberal values. I mean, something as obvious as freedom of speech. Than people who call themselves liberals. And, you know, you've got a lot of people on the left side of the aisle or who call themselves liberal who have been very much like aligning with the establishment, right? Not fighting the power, but becoming the power and, you know, loving big pharma and siding with these giant corporations and even siding with the military industrial complex and all of these things. And it's more sort of, you know, centrist to conservative libertarian leaning people who are more like, huh? Like, no, we do want free speech. Right? It's very odd. I mean, in November, I spoke at a university in Florida. Mm-hmm. And for the first time, I got protested. I've never been protested before.
Congratulations.
This was my first time. Thank you. I'm leveling up. It was my first time in real life, like, you know, dozens of protesters, you know, with anti-Zuby signs and all sorts of stuff. And I was like, wow, this is kind of surreal. And it was funny because my speech, the topic of my speech was why freedom of speech is important. And you've got all these young students there who are trying to deplatform me and trying to ban me from coming to their campus. There's
in
also
Florida.
Sort of in Florida, there's also an extra level of humor to it, given that, you know, trying to stop the black man from coming to campus. And, you know, it's all these angry white calling themselves liberal kids. And I'm just like, this is an interesting turn of events, what's happening here. So how does that, how have you seen that play out? Because I know you're far more outspoken than most on this.
No, I mean, I think that what happened in Iran is happening here, and it's flipped so quickly, and it's the same smell, right? So back there, they were like, why is the Shah living in a castle where there's homeless people like in the streets, you know? So it was this whole like, wealth gap and socialism and fairness and caring for like all people and distribution of wealth. And it's the same stuff, and it flipped so quickly, right? And I just see it flipping so quickly here too. And it sounds great, but anyone who's lived in that socialist communist country and escaped and made it to America will tell you it doesn't work. And they're like, no, but we'll do it differently. And I'm like, no, you won't. It's not conducive to human nature. And it makes people sad. It makes people upset. It makes people feel like they have nothing to reach for. If everyone's getting the same thing and everyone's the same and no one identifies as anything and no one can speak, what's the point? Like, how do you find happiness in that if you can't be an individual and if you can't aspire to goals and to whatever it is that you value and that will fulfill you? So now it's interesting seeing what's happening in Iran. And it's the grandchildren of, and the children of those people who overthrew the Shah that are walking through the streets saying, death to us that we said death to the Shah.
Interesting.
So 40 years later, some people are saying it's the curse of that generation. What's happening to the, you know, their children in Iran because of what they did, this is happening to their children. So it's just very interesting to me. And I'll tell you, like one of the high schools here, even they had a Iranian history course and the kids came home and they're like, Mom, I didn't know the Shah was bad and Khomeini's good. And I'm like, what are they teaching you?
Wow.
And this is, you know, a very like Iranian heavy community in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And if that's happening here, what are they teaching them in these universities? How are they spinning things? Who are these professors? Who put them there? And who's pushing back, more importantly? And that's why I started speaking out, because my daughter applied to my high school, which made me feel super young. But I was just like, you know what? She's 4 years away from college. I got to start saying something. And I just started by just doing hashtag Shabbat Shalom on my Instagram. Mm-hmm. And I got heart palpitations just from that. Like that was an act of courage big time for me, because in Iran, you didn't say you were Jewish. You didn't say anything. We even changed our last name to not sound Jewish, to avoid persecution. And you observed your religion in quiet. So putting a mezuzah on my office door and on my house, saying Shabbat Shalom on Instagram, all of those things I paused and I had, you know, some trepidation. But at the same time, I was just like, if I don't speak up, what kind of world am I leaving behind for my kids, my grandkids, other people's kids? And so I just said, nope, my parents didn't risk everything to bring me this country for me to shut up. So I didn't.
I love that. Honestly, that makes me, I'm so happy to hear that, because it's too rare. And I've become this lightning rod for like non-woke people in every industry and country. The thousands of, you know, messages and DMs and emails from people in, whether they're in Hollywood or they're other musicians or they work in the medical field or they're in media or sports, whatever it is, there's been this big chill, as I'm sure you're aware, right? This chill of people. And it's weird. I mean, in the past few months, I've been to the UK, I've been to Australia, I've been to the States, and it's the similar conversations everywhere, whether that's about the pandemic response or it's about politics or it's about certain social issues. And there's a lot of people who are not with certain narratives and who want to push back. But of course, you know, as you said, you know, they're fearful of whether it's just backlash on social media or losing followers or having their job put at risk or losing sponsors if they're a podcaster or a YouTuber, getting demonetized, getting kicked off of social media. There's all of these concerns, and it's a big shame, because we live in, you know, there are genuinely many places in the world, as you know, of course, you know, where speaking your mind can have like really serious, like super serious consequences, you know, not just, oh, you get canceled or you lose a couple of followers. But when I'm seeing people in the US, in the UK, in Canada, in Western Europe, in Australia, terrified, not just like a bit hesitant, but like terrified to say basic things that aren't even all that controversial, it's very concerning, because it's like, well, if people in the freest countries in the world are afraid to say certain truths or just certain opinions, or even to just say who they are and what they believe, hey, this is who I am, these are my religious beliefs, this is where I'm from, this is what I'm about, especially in this age where there's this sort of trite and shallow obsession with inclusion and diversity and tolerance and equity and whatever. And you hear all these terms all the time, but then at the same time, people are like deathly afraid to deviate a little or to show some diversity or to, it's an interesting thing. Yeah. Ask questions, right? Not even just state an opinion, just go hang on. What about this? Or is that making sense? So I honestly admire and respect the fact that, you know, I think in each of these different professions and sectors and all these different worlds, we need the people who have the backbone, men and women who will just stand their line and ask those questions and make those statements. And they're not worried about being canceled.
Do you think that you and I are at a certain advantage, whether it's with skin color, you know, my gender, my background, that we can say things that maybe some lighter skinned people couldn't say?
No, actually, not really. Not really, because all that happens is you just get different words thrown at you.
I see.
So if you are a black person who has more conservative or libertarian leanings, or is openly in the USA, if you're an open Republican, or you're a fan of Trump or whatever it is, and like, it's safer to say those views as a white man, right? They might call you racist, mm-hmm. right? But actually, that's better than the things they'll call you if you're a black person and you say that and stand on that, right? You're not going to be called a race traitor. You're not going to be called a, you know, you're not going to be called the N-word. You're not going to be called an Uncle T. You're not going to be called a, you know, there's all this terminology, which I think actually can be even worse and sort of more venomous and hostile when people expect you to quote unquote be on their side, right? So maybe as a woman, right? As a woman, there might be, as a woman who's an immigrant, people might think, oh, okay, you're supposed to fit in this box. And then if you don't fit perfectly in that box, then because they expect you to, there's even this sort of greater...
It's like worse. I had an employee who was a lesbian, and she was telling me that she was very moderate in her views, but her you know, gay community made her feel like she was like a part of the KKK or something. Like, yep, there you go. Yeah. So I think you're right in a certain sense. The background and like the diversity, and you having been in Saudi Arabia, or you having grown up, you know, with a little bit more international knowledge, I think can be an advantage too.
Yeah, it certainly can be. But I honestly think that courage is courage. You know, I think that some people simply, we all have excuses. Everyone has excuses to not, right? I mean, you have all the excuses that people use. Oh, you know, oh, I can't speak up. I'm married. I can't speak up. I have kids. I can't speak up. I have a job. I can't speak up. Right. I run a business and I have
clients. Everybody says that right? to me. They're like, what were you thinking?
Yeah, I can't speak up. I'm in LA. I can't speak up. Yeah. I'm in everyone has their excuses, right? Someone won't speak up because they don't make a lot of money and they're afraid to lose that. Someone else won't speak up because they make a lot of money and they're afraid to lose that, right? There's always going to be reasons and excuses for people to just stick their head down and cower away. But I think all of that can be flipped. I mean, you said it yourself. The fact that you have children, I understand that you think about their future, and you think about what country, culture, society do I want them to grow up in? Do I want them to be less free than I was? Do I want them to have fewer opportunities? Do I want them to be judged on their skin color and their ethnicity? Absolutely not. So given where certain things are going, actually, you have to push back, right? Mm-hmm. I don't want my future children growing up in a society where they're taught that they're victims, or that they should have animosity against white people, or that they're oppressed just because they have darker skin tone. Or I wouldn't want my daughter to be thinking that all the men around the world are, you know, running this thing called the patriarchy that's going to oppress her and prevent her from doing this and this, and men are trying to control her. I wouldn't want my sons to think that they're defective girls and that their masculinity is toxic. It's like there's narratives for everybody. You know, there's all these different narratives that are out there. I think the pendulum is swinging back.
Do you think it's going to swing back? Like, you know how like in my industry it went from surgery, non-surgical, surgical? I think there's going to be a swing back. And I think people like us are going to, you know, be at the head of that wave.
I absolutely think so. And I'm already seeing it happening. I've been very outspoken, especially over the past 5 years at this point, 4 or 5 years. And it's far less lonely now than it was even in 2018 or 2019. It's not as lonely, and I can say certain things, and it's a little bit like, you know how the C19 narrative has shifted now?
Yes.
And you can, there's things that you can very openly say or question now, and you don't get the insane backlash. Like, when there were certain things I was saying in March, April 2020, and people wanted to come for my head, right? I was being called the worst things under the sun. You're killing people. You're this, you're that. You know, people are trying to deplatform me off the platforms because I was questioning the lockdowns and questioning masks. This is before the vax even came, right? Then it got even worse. But it's interesting because now, less than 3 years later, it's totally okay to ask those questions. And it's totally, even on YouTube, I mean, there's videos that were getting pulled off YouTube, people getting banned on Twitter, whatever. Now you can say that stuff. Suddenly, like, you can now say it and it's okay. You can't go too far. Right. But people, so the Overton window is reopening.
Did you see that law that came out that said they can pull your medical license if you say misinformation about, like, COVID? But
Canada did the same.
Thank God a couple days ago, a judge put an injunction and a bunch of physicians sued Newsom. And it's on hold, thank God. Good. But I was just like, okay, we're in Iran. Iran has happened.
Yeah, it's crazy. And you know, I think human beings, we always need to be very vigilant of these things. Because I say it on so many podcasts, I remind people all the time that human nature doesn't change. Human nature is the same as it was 100, 500, 1,000, 10,000 years ago. Human nature doesn't change. We get access to better stuff and we have access to history, but there's always that, certainly on a societal level and on a nation level, things always tilt towards authoritarianism. It always tilts towards more and more centralized governmental control, more and more tribalism, more and more, like, that's how it goes. And it can be accelerated when people are afraid. So if you can strike fear into people, whether it's done artificially or from a naturally occurring phenomenon, that's always an opportunity for them to centralize and claim even more power. And then it's hard to get those freedoms and rights back if you give them away. And this cycle just continues and continues. Every single country, as time goes on, it keeps happening. Some countries have better systems to kind of have checks and balances. For example, in the USA, having 50 different states with different governors and more decentralized governance, that certainly helps. Somewhere like the UK, it's much more top down, right? Mm-hmm. It's not like, oh, okay, they're instituting lockdowns here, but they're, you know, the UK doesn't have a Florida, it doesn't have a Texas, it doesn't have a Tennessee, right? It's like, it's just top down. Most countries are more like that. So in the US, there's at least that decentralization, and it's not just like, okay, there's one guy at the top and whatever he says goes. Right. Even on a state level, as you said, Newsom got blocked by, you know, he's trying to implement something and there's checks and balances that prevent him just from becoming dictator of California. So, I just think people always have to be vigilant. But I think that having a few people, having a loud vocal minority sort of standing up and waving the flag and saying stuff that other people don't want to say, it creates just enough sort of chinks in the armor and cracks in the dam to stop stuff from going too crazy. That's why I think that, you know, these conversations are so important.
I agree. Yeah, I think the two things that, you know, I've been seeing that are, you know, are a huge problem is the indoctrination in the universities right now and what's happening to our kids and them being afraid to speak up in university. What's the point of university if you can't talk to people with differing views from you? That scares me a lot. And then the open borders scare me a lot with, you know, I don't know, terrifying. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Well, I think that, the stuff that the stuff that's being pushed, not just at universities now, but even in schools, even from very young ages, I don't know. I don't think it's happening everywhere, but it's pretty widespread. A lot of it is concerning. You know, some of it is outright false, right? There's stuff that kids are being taught where I'm just like, that's literally not true. And I think it's one thing to teach something as a theory, and it's another to teach it as a reality. So if you're in university, for example, you know, I think people should learn about different political philosophies. People absolutely should learn about different religions. People should learn about different social theories. I don't think there's anything wrong with learning about critical race theory as a theory.
I agree. But that's what it was. It was a university course. Yeah.
Exactly, right? You know, there's nothing wrong with learning about Marxism, right? But there's another thing being taught or indoctrinated into having a Marxist worldview and being taught that that is the way to see the world and that's just what it is, right? You could learn the, you know, there's all these theories and ideas that are out there, but I think what's concerning is a lot of it is just being taught as fact, right? It's being taught like, okay, this is just it.
This is objective.
Yeah, this is objective reality. This is the best and most accurate way to look at human society and to look at other people and so on. I mean, just this morning, I got sent, because I get sent a lot of stuff. Oftentimes people want me to share things, but to share them anonymously. And I got sent some stuff from a substitute middle school teacher here in the USA. I don't know, you know, it was an anonymous tip kind of thing. And it was various sheets from the curriculum, particularly on the subject of gender, but then also like race and kind of like the privilege hierarchy. And, you know, they sort of just have very clear sort of diagrams and, you know, sort of explaining, you know, the difference between what they call the difference between sex and, you know, they use the, you know, sex is what you're assigned at birth based on a doctor's judgment. Gender identity is, you know, gender is how you think and feel. And this is, and I'm like, that's not, but it's being stated like, this is just fact. This is just how it is. And it's like, no, this is actual misinformation. And then there was the other one, you know, there was something about the sort of almost like the privilege hierarchy. It was almost like a diagram showing, you know, if you are white and you're male and you're heterosexual and you're Christian, all these things, then you are as close as possible to the to power and privilege. And then on the outskirts of the diagram, they have, you know, immigrants and black people and LGBTQIA and, you know, all these things. And it's just written as if it's just fact, almost like it's science.
Sad. I think it's so sad. Like, I will tell you, like, I'm a surgeon, right? Like, I'm definitely the minority in the surgical world. I never was like, I am at a disadvantage for being a woman. I just worked my ass off pregnant. And when I came out, all of those things that these people would tell me is a disadvantage was my differentiator. It was the reason why I was successful, because I'm like, I'm brown. I understand all sorts of skin. I understand brown skin, or I'm a woman. I, you know, understand what a woman wants and, you know, a female aesthetic. Like, you can make things that they keep telling you is a disadvantage into differentiators when you're marketing yourself or when you're like, so I think it's so sad that they're teaching these kids, like, you're disadvantaged. You are going to have such a tough time making it. It's like, no, we're in the US, we're merit, hard work. And I'm sorry to say it, but talent. So I work really hard. I'm sure there's a lot of other people working hard, but maybe they don't have a certain talent, or maybe they didn't, they were scared to pursue the talents that they have or whatever it is. I truly and honestly believe anyone in the US with hard work and talent and perseverance and grit can make it.
I agree with you. And isn't it amazing that there's a small percentage of people who get angered by such a statement?
Yeah. Right?
I mean, you have every, if you wanted to play victim, like, you've got, you have a lot of cards in your deck, right? You've got a lot of cards in your deck. You could, I'm an immigrant, you know, we had to flee my country of origin. I'm a woman of color, a WOC. You know,
I posted my holiday, like, work party, and somebody, like, messaged, like, I don't see any women of color. And then I looked up the definition and I was like, I'm a woman of color.
You're Jewish. Well, sometimes Jewish is a funny one. Jewish is a funny one.
Jewish is a funny one.
Sometimes you get the victim points. Sometimes you get the oppressor points. It depends on what's convenient at the time. So, you know, sometimes you can play that one. Sometimes they're like, oh, you know, so you're a Zionist oppressor or whatever. But yeah, people have all these weird hangups, you know? And ultimately it's also just divisive. It's like, we have, of course, look, people have their differences like that. And that makes it, that's even what makes life interesting, right? We're not just these clones and drones. Everyone's got their background and their perspective, and they look different, and they've experienced different things and have different personalities and are from different parts of the world. And all of that stuff to me is like, that's awesome. I'm not here trying to put people in some kind of hierarchy or, you know, victim categories.
And the other
or
thing too is
whatever.
Like suffering, I mean, I hate to say it, but it builds character. it gives you maybe a purpose for life. I have a friend who says, if you love someone, you wish them some suffering and some hardship. Because if, you know, like, I actually worry for my children. You know, I'm like, I keep telling them like my suffering and my hardships, like to motivate them to like work harder. But they, you know, it's horrible to say that. But I just think that that's what builds character. It gives people their purpose sometimes is I'm going to fight for this. Or like for me, I'm an activist against anti-Semitism because I suffered anti-Semitism. Or, you know, a lot of me becoming a physician and really, you know, looking into plastic surgery, also was my mother passing away and having a terminal illness. So, you know, it kind of shapes you, these hardships. So instead of victimizing yourself based off of your hardships, you need to channel it into something positive to go out in the world and make positive change. And to, you know, I always say, like, making money and being successful gives you the power to help others. There's no dirty word in success. There's no dirty word in money. You can use that to do a lot of good.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is the way that they've sort of inverted the term privilege, or even
they call me success, privilege, right? And I'm like, actually, I call it success. I like a positive connotation to what I've done with my life, not a feel bad for my hard work and success.
When people call me privileged, I agree and amplify. I'm like, yes, absolutely. I'm very privileged. I was born in the mid 80s in the UK to an intact family with great loving parents who instilled good values in me. I have four wonderful older siblings. Actually, I've never wanted for a meal. I've never not known where my meal is going to come from or where I'm going to sleep. Like, I have all sorts of privileges. I'm able-bodied. Mm-hmm. I speak English as a native language. I'm in good health with no sort of major, you know, with no hereditary illnesses or, man, I could give people reel off 100 privileges that I have off the top of my head. Is that supposed to be a bad thing? Is that supposed to be something?
I just don't like the word because it has a negative connotation. Like, you can, everything you just listed, Zuby, are things you should be grateful for.
They're blessings.
Why not call it things to be grateful for instead
of? This is what's interesting. Well, that's what's interesting, because privilege didn't used to have a negative connotation, right? But the wokies have made it sound negative. If you said someone was privileged in the year 2000, no one would have taken that as a sort of negative thing. It just means that your circumstances and perhaps your parents and family put you in a, you know, my children will be privileged by default whenever I have children. Of course they'll be privileged in various ways. And I think the most important thing, actually, and I think this is part of why, you know, you talked about the struggle and the hardship. And I think what struggle and hardship does, of course, I think why it builds character is maybe perhaps twofold. Part of it is, you know, it's naturally building your strength and resilience like exercising does. Mm-hmm. But I think also that it provides perspective, right? And with perspective comes gratitude. So even when it comes to your children who aren't going to go through some of the hardships that you did, I would say that, I'm saying this as a non-parent, but I would think that as long as they have perspective, right? As long as they understand that, you know, on a global and on a historical scale, you know, just kind of how good they have it. And in fact, that means that they should work in even harder and do even more to sort of give back and make the world better and impact people and all of that. That's certainly how I view things. Then I think as long as you have that perspective, you don't always need to go through all of the battles and the trauma and the hardship that other people have gone through. But it's good to know that people do go through them and that you could go through them and that you're fortunate to not go through them and so on. I think as long as you have that perspective, I think the problem with quote unquote privilege can be if it wraps people up in this bubble and they're sort of disconnected from global and historical reality. And they're not even aware that, like, there's so many people in the world who go through such rough times and they can't empathize and relate and be compassionate about anything because they've been so, you know, sort of wrapped up in cotton. And they also don't know how to deal with like minor issues or obstacles because they've never had them before. To me, I think that's the problem. I think the problem is.
Yeah. But I think woke culture and the wokies, as you call them, are making anyone who's successful, they wrap them in that bubble. Like, they don't know anything about you. They come online, they're like, well, you're privileged, you know? So it's sort of like, there is no deeper digging. There's no like background, nothing.
Yeah. You know, my view honestly is like, for lack of a better term, honestly, like, screw them. Who cares?
Exactly. Right?
If someone doesn't know anything about you and they're just coming with all these aspersions and assumptions and negative connotations based off of, I don't know, your Instagram photo or whatever, like, that's not your problem, right? Like, you can't explain to every moron in the internet who decides to jump to a million conclusions off of nothing, everything about, you know, you don't owe them an explanation. Like, they can be wrong, right? If someone wants to just be wrong, I'm like, okay, you know, that's your right. Something I'm getting better and better at is, and I've been on social media a long time, but, you know, just accepting that, you know, you don't owe everyone a reply. You don't owe everyone an explanation.
No, and sometimes your followers will defend you for you. You don't need to do it yourself.
Exactly. You know, you don't need to jump in. Oh, you know, John 1:4-8:3-6:9 said that I'm, you know, with his eight followers.
With his eight followers,
you don't have to, it's like you don't have to reply to that person. Yeah. You know, and his dog or cat profile photo. It's like, just ignore it, you know. So Sheila, what is next for you?
Oh my gosh. Well, we are expanding into Nevada. That's my, plan B. Okay. So that's big, you know, college applications are coming up for the kids. And, you know, I take it back to one of the things that you said is like being a parent is, you know, the most important job. So I'm really trying to do a good job of, leading and delegating within my businesses so that I am super available for my children, especially in their teenage years. Because I always say, you know, if your kids end up on crack, you failed. It doesn't matter like how successful you are. So I think that, you know, that family life and cultivating that time that you have, they're not getting younger. And, you know, one of them will be off in college in a couple of years. So I'm really just trying to, you know, sit in my faith and sort of think about what's important, what I want to do. I would look around my house. I'm like, okay, we made it. Like, we did it, you know, like, now I need to enjoy it and give back. And so that's really where I'm finding a lot of fulfillment is speaking, educating, being with my family, and just sort of, you know, letting it take its course and see what comes up next. But yeah, no, it's been great. We got a magazine cover coming up, tons of interviews. Hopefully, you know, we'll get another show, just little things, but I'm so just happy and fulfilled. And I just want to spread that message that, you know, you can have it all. It just takes a minute to get there. Like, you have to work hard and sacrifice, but you can get to the point where, you know, you do have it all. So
that's beautiful. And Sheila, where can people find and follow you online?
Yeah. So my main Instagram is Dr. Sheila Nazarian, Dr. Sheila Nazarian. And my podcast that I just did, I'm venturing into, you know, Zuby world. It's called The Closet. We had Megan McCain as our first guest, and we had Nate Bozulik as our second guest, and we're interviewing Yeonmi Park, who I'm sure you know, the North Korean defector, tomorrow. But it's so funny, yeah, because my agent friends were like, you should do a podcast on beauty. And I'm like, I can't. There's too much work to do.
I hear that. That's amazing. Yeah. Sheila, thank you so much for coming on the show. I've really loved talking to you. I admire you.
I admire you. Work. You too.
Thank you.
Sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the gram. Stunt me, you're destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam. Put some respect on my name. Sick like Cobain, click and I bang. Y'all gon' remember the name. Y'all gon' remember the name.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.